Welcome to Parallel Lines, episode 3 already. And we're going to try and do some myth-busting today because Anna Jane knows stuff.
Well, Anna Jane knows some stuff, but as promised, we said we'd do some kind of heavier topics with a lighter touch. So we're gonna keep this still quite kind of upbeat, but we're going to talk through some things that people are interested in, some things that get some coverage, and we can maybe uncover and myth-bust a little bit. How's about that?
How's about that? Definitely. It's, I think, fair to say it's been a difficult year and a half, 2 years for the railways. People out there that use the railways aren't happy.
Mm-hmm.
They're critical, maybe sometimes with the wrong people for the situation we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I get asked to go and explain it a lot on the radio, and you get on the telly. I don't get asked anymore since they've discovered you.
That's not true, Tony.
If they phone me, I know you're poorly. But you know, we do get asked to explain things a little bit, but this might wrap some of the stuff up also that we've talked about in radio interviews as well. And again, if this makes you think I'd like to know more about that, then email us, because we'll pick it up in a future discussion, and we'll maybe even get somebody in
who knows even more than I do.
we might get a driver in to tell us how to drive a train or something.
We'd love to do that. So I think we're in charge of the editing, or rather you're in charge of the editing today, Tony, which is one of the things when you and I speak on the radio or on the television about this, we get asked to explain some pretty complex concepts and topics, and they tend to give us, you know, seconds, or if we're really lucky, a few minutes to explore something. And it's never enough, is it? And it's only ever driven by the questions that they ask us. And with the best will in the world, the journalists want a bit of sensationalism, and they want to cover really particularly narrow aspects of these topics. So we're going to try and come at it from what we'd like to tell people about, and take a little bit more time over it. And we're going to start with train crew today, aren't we? And I guess this mainly will be about drivers, because that's who end up in the headlines the most.
And that is the one that is still sort of the real big current dispute. And it's great because we've got a little bit of time to talk about it. I would just say, yes, on the radio, I remember once being asked, explain sort of the railways, life, the universe and everything. And a voice in my ear said, you have 37 seconds. So we have a little bit longer.
The way, don't talk too quickly because people need to understand what you're saying.
I did it in 36 and went, da-da. Right. So let's talk about particularly some of the things that actually aren't the fault of the evil privatised railway operators, because a lot of people think that many of the problems that are going on at the moment that we're trying to negotiate through came because the private operators are evil, money-grabbing whatevers. And yet they inherited a lot of things that have existed for years. So let's talk about some of them.
Yeah, let's start with a history lesson. This is always helpful, isn't it? So one of the myths, is that, you know, privatisation has led to all of these ills that we have. But one of the ills that it didn't create, and this is fact, actually, this isn't opinion. So let's at all times separate fact from opinion. It is a fact, actually, that drivers, train drivers, have always had some of these elements that we talk about. So they've always worked their rest days, they've always worked overtime, they've always had constraints on, you know, how long they can drive for, where they've got knowledge to drive, which route and traction they can have on their card. And these things were baked in way before privatisation. I mean, actually, some of them were even more segregated before privatisation, because, you know, the route card things and what have you actually were directly related to their salary at one point way before privatisation. So you'd have, you know, intercity drivers who got paid a different wage to regional drivers. Now, of course, we have separate operating companies who dictate the wages of the drivers, and that is reflected in where they go. But generally, that was not a thing that was created by privatisation. It was there before. And then privatisation came along, and the drivers did really well out of it, because the way they've bargained through their trade union, ASLEF, which represents most of the drivers, ASLEF doing their job, doing what they're supposed to for their members, they've been negotiating for the past, you know, 20, 30 years separately with multiple train operating companies, not all at the same time. So they've been able to kind of, as you would do, pick and choose the best bits of the terms and conditions and buy and sell different things to different companies and dare I say, you know, ratchet up the numbers a bit over the years to, you know, they've got this much, so we want a little bit more because, you know, we can. And so that's kind of, in many ways done well for the drivers because they didn't used to get paid very much at all under BR. They were by no means the best paid in the industry, which is, I think, what they're considered to be now. So, yeah, BR created some issues that were baked in. Privatisation has maybe exacerbated a few of them.
And I'm right, aren't I, that some of the things like the maximum number of hours in the regular working week, say working 35 hours over 4 days or whatever it was, that I remember those discussions in the 70s and 80s with British Rail and getting them through. So those were some baked in terms and conditions that happened in British Rail days. And then things like working on Sundays, because salaries were quite low, people were quite happy to volunteer to work on Sundays because actually it matters seriously then on their ability to pay their mortgage or to feed their family. So people, we've got this, you know, we've written it down about volunteering to work. People were happy to work overtime additional days in the week because it was actually at that time in British Rail days the way you actually got to a reasonable salary. And it's got locked into, even though they're doing considerably better now, it's still the same system for how many hours a week you work and so on, some of which are safety related. You can't work so many hours without a break or so many hours continuously driving because there are stuff in law now about how many hours you can work and then you have to have a break for safety reasons.
So let's just break that down a little bit. There's a lot in there, okay? So how many hours can you work in a week? Well, let's think back to, you know, British Rail days. Let's say the 80s. Let's pick a fictional date in the 80s because that's well before privatisation. In the 80s, actually, working hours in the week were different for everybody. We didn't have all this, embedded work and time directive. We didn't understand as much about safety. People worked differently generally. And train drivers are no exception. So they used to have their working week, and then a lot of them used to like working overtime to supplement their income. But that wasn't a train driver thing. That would be the same if you spoke to someone who worked in a factory or down a pit or, you know, lots of different things. So that was quite normal in the 80s. I say this like I was around. I was a child in the 80s, of course, but we're doing a history lesson here. And then we had a thing that was called flexible rostering, where in the 80s, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, we could Google this, but I think it's 1986, rings a bell.
I wouldn't normally interrupt Anna Jane at such an important time, but I'm actually in the edit suite and we've Googled it. It's 1982, not 1986. It's 1982 when all of this happened. Now, back to Anna Jane.
The drivers agreed to be essentially bought out of that way of working and to benefit the rostering of train crew and to make, it was supposed to buy more flexibility, hence the name, flexible rostering. So they were supposed to get more of a flat salary, and then in that you would have flexibility within the diagrams. So it would make it more beneficial for rostering people. It didn't kind of work out as well as planned. So we got a bit of the flexibility, but we retained some of the rigidity. And it happened to greater or lesser extent in different operating companies after privatisation. But Sundays, interestingly, it was a long time before Sundays became anything near part of the working week for drivers. And if you think about it, that's not just train drivers either, actually. Because, for instance, when I had my first job, which is quite a long time ago now, but not as long ago as the 80s, my first weekend job was a Sunday only contract in a shop, because at the time shop workers didn't want to work Sundays. Retail on a Sunday was quite a new thing in the 90s and early 2000s. Lots of places still didn't open. Nowadays we have become more of a 7-day economy. Generally speaking, people expect to be able to go out and shop, go out and eat, go out and do leisure activities in particular on a Sunday in the same way that they would on a Wednesday. And so contracts are catching up with that. And over the years, every time we've had a pay deal, every few years, the drivers negotiate a new pay deal. And so Sundays have been bought by the companies in lots of the train operating companies, but not all of them. So some of them still rely on volunteers on a Sunday. And as we've said, that suited both parties really well for a long time, because it means you can employ fewer drivers if you're the company, but you supplement it with the overtime on a Sunday. And as far as the drivers are concerned, it means I don't have to work a Sunday, but I can when I want to. That's quite harmonious, isn't it? That's very nice for everyone. And it used to work a lot better when we didn't run a full service on a Sunday, but now it's pretty close to a 7-day railway in most parts of the country. So you need more drivers to say yes. And if you're one of the operating companies that relies on volunteers, of course, that creates uncertainty, doesn't it? Because certain times of the year, for instance, in the summer, when it's nice weather and the kids are on holiday and all the rest of it, maybe people want to work less on a Sunday because they'd prefer to be at a barbecue with their kids or, you know, whatever it might be. In the winter, when it's cold and it's dark and maybe you don't want to have to get up for work any more than you absolutely have to, you get fewer volunteers. So it's become more of a problem in recent times. And that's one of the things that it would be great to harmonise if a deal could be done. But it's not a problem that was created by privatisation. It existed before.
It takes us on to a couple of questions. And the first one is, do the companies employ enough drivers to not need that overtime anymore? But that also links into, if they have enough drivers, then they need to change things around a bit so they have got them available any day of the week as they need them.
Well, so this is a myth-busting thing, isn't it? Do they have enough drivers? And I suppose the answer is generally yes, just about, if all things are equal and everything's going well. So that's a bit of a... I was taught a phrase years ago when I was cutting my teeth in the rail industry that there's a lovely phrase, every time, all the time, except for when it's not. And I think it really applies to this because it's not the case that companies deliberately employ, you know, a certain percentage fewer drivers or, you know, cut the number per se. I'm sure that has happened over the years. And I think that's been driven by cost cutting. It's been driven by overly onerous, you know, bottom lines in franchise bids and what have you. But generally speaking, everybody involved in the railway wants to run a good railway. So it makes no sense to employ less drivers than you need or less guards than you need to run the railway. However, what happens is you do your kind of calculations of how many you need to run the base service. And that's, you know, number X. Then a bunch of other things happen that are either really not within your control. So, for instance, sickness levels of those drivers, you cannot predict, you know, if you have a pandemic or a swine flu or, you know, just a particularly bad year for flu, for example, you know, that will affect the number of drivers you've got. And no better planning, no more generosity in your bottom line would help with that because it's a genuine unknown. So that's pretty difficult. Then there's some kind of known unknowns or even knowns that are really difficult to plan for in terms of fluctuations in your bottom line. And the best analogy I can find to explain this one, again, comes back to a retail example for some reason. So at Christmas every year, shops all over the country and restaurants and other things will employ additional people for the Christmas period. Yep. Because it's busier at that time of year, you need more people. And they take them on a flexible contract that's maybe, you know, 12 weeks long. It suits the workers because that's what they want. And it suits the company because they don't want to carry that head for the rest of the year. And it works really well because that type of worker doesn't require much in terms of, you know, training and development to get up to speed in time for the busiest period. So they maybe take them on a few weeks before the really busy period and by the time they get there, it's good. You can't do that with train drivers. So when you have something like, say, an engineering block, that means a diversionary route is needed and everything's going to take twice as long to get round Birmingham, you know, or whatever it might be. You need more drivers for a period of time and you can't just take on a few extra drivers for 6 months. It doesn't work like that. So unless you knew about that engineering work 5 years in advance, and that might sound ridiculous, 5 years, but it would be that long that you would probably need to know in order to recruit, train, get them fully competent, you know, get them exactly where you need them to be. And then what do you do with them afterwards? When the engineering work's finished, you've got these people who you've invested thousands in to train, but now you don't have enough work to go around. So it's really difficult. It looks like we haven't got enough drivers. We have, but it's just really difficult to match it perfectly on an ongoing basis. Did that make sense, Tony? Did that make sense to you? Because it's a good start if it makes sense to you.
It did. So let's add on to that. As you said, in retail, they find someone and they say, we just need you for 6 weeks over Christmas. So we'll take you for 8 weeks, 2 weeks to get into the thing and 6 weeks work. How long does it take to take a person off the street and make them a competent driver and why?
Okay, good one. That's a really great question. So, I mean, basically it takes about 12 to 18 months to get a train driver from street to seat, as we would call it. So a totally new driver, or even it could be, we would still class them as new if perhaps they'd worked on a station or as a conductor beforehand, because they still haven't driven before. So you'd have to take them all the way through from the beginning. There's obvious advantages to having worked on the railway before, but you'd still be new. And even when they get to that last point, so 12 to 18 months later, they invariably won't be fully productive for you because they'll have the main routes. They'll have learned the main routes, the main traction. You know, they'll be competent. They'll be safe to drive a train. But for example, they won't have any diversionary route knowledge. So if they needed to go the back way or there was an incident and they needed to go around something, they probably wouldn't have that for a little while longer. And that's partly, so let's look at the different building blocks to that. Why does it take so long? Well, you know, this is a safety critical job. It's pretty important that these people know what they're doing. There's a lot of operating rules that they need to learn, huge volumes of information in the rule book that they need to know about. The trains themselves, they need to know everything about how that train works, you know, what to do in the event of a failure, what are all these lights doing, telling me different things about it, all these lights and noises. They need to know every single signal on the route, because if their train comes to a stand, they need to know exactly where they are and where they're going. So there's so much information, and you know, we're human beings, aren't we? You can only take on so much at a time. It takes quite a while to work through and absorb all that information, test them to make sure they have absorbed it. They need to do practical handling, so they need to have a go at driving the train in a safe environment where they're accompanied by somebody who knows what they're doing. Part of that's done with simulation as well nowadays, which is a great safe environment to learn. So it does take a long time. Yeah.
And that familiarisation with the route is very important, because there are sections on routes where you need to slow down, or you need to know where you need to start slowing down for a station stop or a junction.
And quite precisely, these are great big bits of kit, but if you don't start braking at exactly the right place, you won't stop in time.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yes. And I'll tell you a story that just proves how precisely train drivers know it. So I was in the cab going from Manchester to London a few years ago, and the driver said to me, "Now there is a speed restriction coming up. I've got to slow down to 110. He said, I'll look for the orange sports car in the car park on the right. And sure enough, as we came round, there's an orange sports car parked in the right. He said, "This is where I start braking." So I, for a moment, I thought that's very clever. And then I said, "All right, what happens if the car's not there?" And he said, "Well, two things. A, it's always been there, and I don't know whose it is because it's always been there. But B, I look in the car park." And that's the point, actually.
Yeah.
I know when I see that car park that that's the point where I start to slow down, and that's my route knowledge is. So that, and that's the sort of precision that, that drivers have. I start applying the brakes, and the passengers won't be uncomfortable. If I start slowing at that point, everything feels comfortable, and I hit the thing, and I won't get done for speeding. And yes, they do have speed guns out on the railways. I've seen them out with it. And drivers can get done with the speed gun for overspeeding as well as their in-cab technology. So it's not something where they can just treat it lightly either.
No, it's not. And that means, you know, for instance, if your train is running late and you're sitting there thinking, "Well, can't you just put his foot down? We can, you know, get the time back." Well, no, you can't, because each section of the line has its speed limit. It has its, you know, its speed limit dictated by the features of that piece of line. So, you know, what is the gradient, and what is it, there a corner, is it a straight bit of railway, this kind of thing. So they know all of that, and some of it is quite imperceptible to us as passengers. I remember when I first did a cab ride in an HST on the East Coast Mainline, and we were coming out of Durham. Now, Durham is quite a hilly place, but when you're in Durham station itself as a passenger, I don't think you really notice. You'd think it was quite flat. It's not at all. It's actually quite hard to get going. You know, the driver has to really give it some to get going when they're coming out of the station. And I didn't realise that until I was sat there in the cab thinking, "Well, this is a different perspective." You know, they know all of that. They know exactly how much power they need to give to get going. They know exactly how much they need to brake. And increasingly nowadays, with the technology we have on train, it's all recorded. So as part of their assessment cycle, their manager will be talking through with them, "Well, how did you drive this day? Did you drive, you know, safely, efficiently? You know, will this have offered a good passenger experience? Is anybody spilling their coffee, you know, because of the way you're driving?" That they can tell that from the technology on the train. So it's quite a lot of responsibility driving around with hundreds of people behind you, and ultimately you're in charge of their lives. So, you know, you could say, well, it should take a year, year and a half to train them, because, well, you'd want them to know what they're doing, wouldn't you?
Indeed. And you can Google this, listeners, if you want to Google the whole thing. But people talk about punctuality in Japan as being very precise. And certainly until recently, train drivers who were late, who didn't drive exactly to the speed and were late, could face some quite unpleasant punishments.
In Japan, not in the UK.
No, we're talking Japan still. Really quite nasty punishments. I think it's been wound down a bit, but even, you know, scrubbing railheads with a wire brush, you know, things like that. There is a very well-documented incident of a commuter train where they were running late for various reasons, and the driver and the guard agreed that he would try and make up time by driving faster. The train derailed on a tight curve, ploughed into a block of flats, and there were a lot of fatalities. That's what happens when somebody panics and thinks, I'd better break the rules because I want to catch up. And it's a lesson that many drivers over in the UK are aware of, that one. That is what happens. And that's why they don't put the foot down and say, I'll try and make time up.
Yeah. And so a lot of what a driver is there for, and you know, it's something that's observed of drivers and of signalers and guards and train managers as well, is a lot of what they do is pretty straightforward. You could even describe it sometimes as simple when things are going well. I hasten to say simple because probably somebody will write in and say, there's nothing simple about it, Anna-Jane, but hear me out what I'm about to say. Where they really earn their money, where they really earn their keep, those types of roles, is actually when things go wrong. When you haven't got time to think about what the right response is, when you have to react quite quickly because of all that training, all that knowledge that you've got, you know what to do in an incident, you know, when something's broken on the train, or when, you know, something up ahead doesn't look as it should, or when you're having to do anything out of course, particularly when those things have got a safety implication, that's what all that training's for. And that's what, you know, they're professionals, they know what to do in that scenario.
And that is why safety still comes first on things, doesn't it? You know, I've seen people recently with the bad weather saying, oh, for goodness sake, just go for it. Now, if you've seen the pictures of what's happened recently with trains that have hit trees, then that's why we don't just go for it. And that's a strong lesson. Now, you and I have both driven simulators, which is only a sort of scratching the surface of what it's like to drive a train, but it is...
It's very insightful.
And I presume on your training, we didn't discuss this beforehand, so this is literally me finding out, presumably the people running the simulators made things happen in front of you or whatever.
I remember there being a horse involved, for instance.
I drove through a lorry on fire across the track my first one. And it is very important, because what they do then is see how the drivers react to that situation. And it's what you do next that's important. I drove through this lorry on fire in the simulator, just again to remind you. But the first thing, you know, I radioed in the signal people and told them that I'd driven through a lorry on fire, and they said, so what train reporting number are you? And I said, I don't know, I'm just on the simulator. And they said, sorry driver, you've got into the train and you don't know what your reporting number is. And they took it absolutely seriously and wiped the floor with me. But it's that level of detail that if you don't get the information right to the right people, then more disaster could follow if trains aren't stopped in the right place before they arrive on the scene or whatever. There's a lot of stuff to do if things go wrong. And it's important that simulators and things like that, but that's why it takes so long, because they've got to go through all those sorts of scenarios with drivers. What would you do if... In those 12 to 18 months.
And so that's, you know, coming back to myth busting, you know, often get asked, oh, so do these drivers all earn £100,000 a year? You know, they're the highest paid people in the industry. So to answer that, well, yes, it is possible to earn £100,000 a year as a driver. And there'll be many examples of people who do. But that's a combination of, they don't all get paid that, certainly not as their basic salary. I don't think anybody's getting paid that to drive a train as their basic salary, although some are not far off maybe in the freight industry now. But it reflects the type of driving they're doing, and it ranges, you know, from way, way, way lower than that, based on the types of trains, the amount of trains, the amount of routes they're driving, how much overtime they do. But a lot of the salary is baked in to represent and recognise that safety element, that, you know, you're paying these people to know what to do and to look after hundreds of people's safety. This is not the same as you and me getting in our car. And, you know, and even you'd recognise, and I know this from people, you tend to drive differently depending if you've got anybody else in the car with you. And particularly maybe if you've got children or even your own children in the car with you, you definitely feel like you have a responsibility to drive, you know, more safely. Imagine that when it's your livelihood and it's hundreds of people you don't know. And then, by the way, there's trains coming the other way with hundreds more people on those. You know, that's what we're paying them a lot of money for. And I think it's just worth remembering that sometimes, that the salary reflects the responsibility.
Yes. I'll just pick up on a couple of things you said, because there's some lighter things as well. As you talked about driving, I gave the managing director of a train company a lift back from an event in my car a few years ago, and the railway was closed, and we'd been to look at the work that was being done. That's why we couldn't go back on the train. And the Secretary of State for Transport, I'm being very vague here, so no years, no.
There have been many, Tony. It would be hard for us to know which one you're talking about.
We were all going to another event, and the Secretary of State for Transport was also going to another event. And his car shot past us on the motorway. We were doing 70, and his car with his police escort went past us at quite a considerable difference.
Oh. So, well, at least they had a police escort, which might have made them safer.
But we did just comment, Secretary of State, you can break all the rules, apparently, Secretary of State for Transport, so that's interesting.
Oh.
Just one other thing, you know, because it's been part of the debate, and we maybe have to, we'll do this another day, but it's only because it's sort of relevant again, the thing about driver operation, who controls the doors and all those kind of things that are still an ongoing discussion. I happened to see the very first driver-only operated train that ran on British Rail by accident. I was a student and I'd been visiting a friend in St Albans, caught a train back to St Pancras. And in the days in the early 1980s, you could still tell when something important was happening on British Rail because they all put their bowler hats on. And you can find all the traditional British Rail managers that are still out there still have their British Rail bowlers. And I noticed St Pancras was swarming with bowler hats. So I had my cameras on me, but no film. I ran to the nearest Boots, bought some film, got back. And the very first driver-only operated train came in and was met by Sir Peter Parker, or maybe just Peter Parker, then chairman of British Rail, who greeted the driver and so on. And that was the beginning of it. It was British Rail that started it. There'd been a year and a half's dispute over it, with the trains being blacked while they discussed how it would happen. But I saw it happen. It was a very momentous thing because it did change the way we look at the railways. If you want to see the picture, there's a picture in the National Railway Museum in the timeline of the railways. It's my picture. I was the only non-press photographer there, and I discovered it by accident. But some of these things, again, go back to British Rail. They're not recent inventions. They're things that happened in the timeline of the railways as we looked at doing things in a different way.
Do you know what? I'm so glad you've mentioned that, Tony. It's a really good example, and one I'm sure my colleagues wouldn't mind me mentioning. So I have the great privilege of working nowadays with two colleagues who've got over 40 years in the industry, started as British Rail graduates. And I know that Keith, who won't mind me naming him in particular, often says it's a source of great disappointment and regret to him that we didn't manage to get driver-only operation through in the way that it was supposed to be from that date that you're talking about then, because it's not a new thing. And it sometimes gets lauded around in the press as though it's, again, those pesky, greedy, privatised train operators trying to save money by getting rid of guards. It was thought of decades ago, and it has been operating on some parts of the network since then. We have driver-only operation on some parts of the network, but it's become this horrible thing that gets, you know, battered back and forth and has become very political, when actually it's nothing to do with privatisation. It was long before that, the brainchild of British Rail, and to do with the technology moving on and all the rest of it. So I'm really glad you mentioned that. It's a shame that it hasn't been resolved yet, and hopefully one day we'll get to a more sensible position on that. So another thing I get asked about is sometimes, why do drivers ring in sick so much? So let's again look at, you know, kind of fact versus fiction. It is true to say that the drivers have pretty high levels of sickness compared to our types of office-based jobs, certainly. But there's some pretty good reasons for that, and we've kind of touched on some of them if you think about it. It's a really heavily safety-related job. You want these guys to be top of their game, don't you, if they're looking after hundreds of passengers at the back of the train. And so imagine, Tony, it's winter. You've got man flu. I mean, it afflicts most of your people, doesn't it? At least once a year. And we on my side of the gender divide feel terrible for you that you're going through this horrific experience. But in your line of work, you know, you probably go and buy some cold and flu remedy, drug yourself up and kind of just soldier on through the day with lots of sympathy from somebody around you. If you're driving a train, it's really hard to do that for a couple of reasons. One, you're probably not allowed to take the same medicine because you're very heavily restricted in terms of drug and alcohol policy, which extends to over-the-counter medicines that you're not allowed to take because they impair your, you know, cognitive ability and what have you. So you probably can't take the really good stuff that's going to make you feel loads better. And secondly, if you're coughing, sneezing, you know, feeling generally really rotten, and that thick head feeling that you get with a horrible cold or flu, I'd imagine the last thing you want to be doing is driving a train continuously for hours, you know? So it's no wonder. And that's not even mentioning we can get into toilet humour, but what if you've got a problem at the other end, you know, and you've only got a certain amount of toilet breaks in your diagram, because that's how driving a train works. You are told when you can visit the loo. You can't just think, oh, I'm going to stop the train and, you know, pop off and have a break here. It's literally planned for you. So if you're going to need that toilet more than usual, probably not the place to be driving a train, is it? So there's probably some good reasons. And that's not even getting into, you know, back injuries. You've got to sit down a lot, or, you know, any other kind of bits and bobs on your body that might not be working correctly.
And of course, if you've got all those bugs, what you don't want to do is go into a mess room and pick up the kettle and then share it amongst your mates. Because then we get onto the thing, oh, suddenly there's eight drivers all ringing them from the same. How come they're all off sick at the moment? Oh, because one of them went in, gave something that's not just a mild cough to everybody, and they're all off now at the same time. So
yeah, and particularly in the days before COVID, when, you know, I mean, hand sanitizer now is quite a normal thing to see, or to carry in your bag or whatever, and nobody would think it was unusual if you perhaps got an anti-bac wipe out and, you know, wipe down the telephone if you were using a shared telephone, for instance, in an office. Well, if you think back a few years, drivers were sharing the in-cab equipment, and if you've just taken over from somebody who, you know, had something and has touched that, you can see how you could, like you say, very much end up with half a depot off sick because they've interacted over the course of a day or two. So, and if half your depot's off, that's really hard to cover. However many spare drivers you've got and however many of them want to work overtime. Coming back to where we started, have we got enough drivers? We probably have until norovirus takes hold at your depot, and then there's not a great deal you can do about it.
We're running, as they say on all the good shows, we're running rapidly out of time. We haven't even discussed the fact that at some companies they've got an over-average age driver population, so they know that they're at a critical point because they need to recruit more than they have for ages. We haven't even touched on how many extra drivers you need when you're buying lots of new trains, and you've got to take them all out for quite a few weeks to train them how to drive the new trains on all the routes they'll be driving on, etc. So there are other layers to this that we've not even got close to.
And I think that just means we'll have to come back and talk about this again, and it would really lend itself to a guest, wouldn't it, to explore this a bit further with us. So let's park those issues for next time. And if anyone's got a good suggestion about who they think we should have on, please send it in. Otherwise, we'll come up with one. Email address, Tony, can we remind people?
Yep. Voice over voice again. Contact at pllines.com. That's contact at pllines.com. We'd love to hear from you. We're waiting for your call.
Wonderful voiceover. I'll never tire of hearing that. So thanks again for listening. Do keep in touch, and we'll be back again with some more musings and hopefully some more myth busting. I've really enjoyed that, Tony. Thanks.
And it's been great. See you soon.